The following is a special archive edition of Michael McCusker's A Story Told.
Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Before I begin what I plan to do, I just received a letter from the White House turning down an invitation that I made to the president to have our mutual birthday dinner together at the Ship Inn on August 19th. A friend gave me a rather bountiful gift receipt, and I thought I'd share it with Mr. Clinton. But according to his Director of Presidential Scheduling, Stephanie S. Street, with two T's at the end, the tremendous demands on the president's schedule do not permit the White House to honor your request. Please know your request was given full consideration and that President Clinton appreciates your interest. And I'm thanked for contacting the White House. So I guess I have to eat my birthday dinner alone. Make like a glutton with the bountiful gift that I have received. Well, today is a day of anniversaries. Well, yesterday was also. Yesterday was, as you probably well know, the 210th anniversary of the Bastille. And today is an anniversary I will get into a little bit later. But first, another one is the 20th. And it's of my newspaper, the North Coast Times-Eagle, the 20th anniversary. And I would like to read a little manifesto, you might say, that I wrote in regards to it, which will appear in the paper that goes to press tomorrow, the 20th anniversary issue. Well, I'd like to read my manifesto. And I have to say that this that I'm going to read in the next few minutes is my opinion and my opinion only, perhaps in the entire universe and whatever other universes are stacked upon or folded around each other. I call it The Eagle Has Landed, which is what, if you remember, Collins called in 10 years before I published When the Moonlander Hit the Moon. The Eagle Has Landed. And I start with a quote by the Reverend Billy Holtz, editor and publisher of The Upper Left Edge in Cannon Beach. Censorship is more obscene than obscenity. And then I quote a part of my first editorial from Volume 1, Number 1, 20 July, 1979. The only corpse successfully revived in recorded history was that of Lazarus, who was said to have lived for several years afterward. Jesus Christ is reported to have arisen from the dead, but even the most ardent supporters of his resurrection admit he was on earth only 40 days, and Jonah was still alive when the whale spit him ashore. Countless other claims of resurrection or rebirth have been made, not least among them Count Dracula and Richard Nixon. With such inspired precedent, the North Coast Times-Eagle is born again. And that was actually the lead paragraph of the first editorial, Volume 1, Number 1, of my version of the Times-Eagle. There was an earlier one printed in Wheeler for 5 years. I picked it up after it had been in its crypt for 3 years. And that begins my story. 30 years ago, Americans rode an eagle to the moon. 10 years later, when gas shortages made it difficult to get home from work, a 3-year dead eagle emerged from a crypt and declared itself reborn. The resurrected eagle celebrates its 20th birthday, July 20th, 1999. 30 years to the day a human spaceman stepped outside his space bird and described the arid, barren moonscape in front of him as a magnificent desolation. The born-again bird reawakened into a desolate world of its own. Instead of lifeless, the planet swarmed with billions of busy, ambitious creatures who carelessly despoiled Gaia in their unceasing drive to transform Terra into their own hubris. A few of the species impoverished the many, yet strangled on the affluence of their affluence. Half of humanity was at least underfed. Millions killed each other or planned to. Truth, as usual, was the first casualty. The North Coast Times-Eagle is born again, its first editorial proclaimed, because First Amendment newspapers have become as rare as the nation's symbol, the bald eagle, which has recently been removed from the endangered species list by the president, who turned down my invitation. The independent press has virtually disappeared, homogenized into huge corporations that control the country and probably the world. In this age of the great systems, devotion to any principle other than the status quo seems quaint and naive and faintly dangerous. But the enormous pressures of population and economics threaten the way we live. The great contradictions between freedom and property have finally reached us. Like everything else, the role of the press is in question. There should be no doubt. The press should have no other special interest than the First Amendment. This becomes patently impossible when the press is controlled by corporations whose interests are often in conflict with the Constitution. The great renegade journalist A.J. Liebling once said the press was free only to those who owned one. And that was from the first editorial. 20 years later, the Cold War over, Russian communism swept into the dustbin of history, the USA, the world's most supreme superpower since the Roman Empire, China once more on the rise, the nation and its citizens are plugging rapturously into an electronic superhighway of infotainment that proposes infinite possibilities and no few dark prophecies. Government and the newly consolidated mediocrities desire control of the worldwide computer internet that until recently was used primarily by rural traffic, scientists, nerds, and lovelorn. Power in the new world corporate capitalist order is shifting to control the manipulation of the immense flow of information, up until recently a vital resource, but now a post-Orwellian system of indoctrination, propaganda, and sensationalism. The information highway is plastic, fluid, and still unpredictable, despite corporate and government invasion of its cyberspaces. But the pervasive ambitions of monopoly are felt and reverberate through electronic and print networks. The concentration of media ownership is ominous and significant cause for public paranoia. Huge conglomerates own and manipulate information that is increasingly vital for the survival of personal and public freedoms while simultaneously producing mediocrity. The persistent efforts by government and powerful elites to control public dialogue, particularly in matters of social behavior, have always been dangerous and usually the guise for authoritarian usurpation of the apparatus of communication. Realization of this led directly to the First Amendment, which states clearly and simply that neither government nor anyone else has the right to deny or interfere with freedoms of speech, press, or religion, or with public gatherings. Without an independent press, journalism is hardly more than a useful method of misleading the public, of providing illusions and deceits to thwart and atrophy personal and collective values and liberties. An important assumption of democracy is that the flow of information should not be restricted or tampered with. But of course, interfering with and manipulating information is a high priority of political and corporate power that accurately assumes the general populace will not give much thought or greatly resist mind control efforts most of the time. If anyone took stock of the contemporary use of press and speech freedoms, it should confirm the worst cynicisms about the tastes of the greater mass of people, most of whom acquiesce to banal, violent, and sexually exploitive entertainment, addicted to spectacle and blatantly commercial rituals conjured by shameless promoters who appeal to base and witless instincts for no loftier purpose than to sell a product and make a buck. The small independent press in America and throughout the world provides a necessary forum for the exchange, analysis, understanding, and arguments that are the basis of any culture or society. Their goals are in miniature the same as are debated everywhere on earth: to assist in the eradication of sexism, racism, poverty, and war, and to document the dooms and glooms, the perversities and horrors, rarely its triumphs, of our busy, ill-tempered species. Small independent newspapers such as the North Coast Times-Eagle dwell in local obscurity. They are often in opposition to bland or autocratic community rule and standards of their circulation areas. The fringe is most normally their habitat, from which they operate happily, however bitter their goals, or from despair their momentum. They incubate and hope to hatch ideas or ideologies that hold them captive. Controversy, flirtation with original ideas, or any other form of journalistic experimentation is anathema to megamedia, which consolidates immense technologies to hype the salacious, mendacious, and indigestible. Out on the fringe, publications like the North Coast Times-Eagle struggle mightily to survive in this era of media titans. The NCTE is a member of the poverty press. It is one of a few small presses obsessed with a vision unaffected by commerce. Commercial media prints and broadcasts to make a buck. Public media chases a buck to print or broadcast. It is descended from radical newspapers that blossomed briefly in the 1950s and 1960s, but its lineage threads back to the prickly press that fostered the First Amendment and Oregon's later, even more stringent guarantee of press freedoms, Article 1, Section 8 of the state constitution, which reads, quote, "No law shall be passed restraining the free expression of opinion or restricting the right to speak, write, or print freely on any subject whatever, but every person shall be responsible for the abuse of this right. And that's Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon State Constitution. The independent advocacy press has few pretensions toward objectivity and fewer illusions about its probability. Most small independent journals are understaffed, underfunded, and generally misunderstood because they seldom reflect popular opinion. They act, often myopically and insensitively, as consciences and torchbearers, and most are fierce and shrill advocates of large or esoteric causes. They are usually on hard times and fail more often than they are replaced. Although small newspapers like the North Coast Times-Eagle and listener-sponsored public radio stations such as KMUN-FM in Astoria and Portland's KABU defy the trend toward megabig, a significant trend in media traffic is paradoxically toward specific or more ominously specialized audiences. Mainstreaming more often seems to mean segmenting into selective user groups that become hermetically sealed by appropriate media. In the 20 years the North Coast Times-Eagle has been out of its three-year tomb, the world far and near has proceeded with its usual human melodrama of wretchedness, poverty, squalor, ignorance, needless tragedy, injustice, and wanton slaughter, and here and there a few laughs. The main frame of human life remains essentially as it has been for millennia, despite recent influxes of a parallel virtual reality. Lean, hungry, improvident, and hogtied by its own paradoxical vows of poverty that dovetail with probability and implicitly limit financial contact with ideologically incorrect sources of wealth and funding that spread the diseased creed of consumer consumption through mainstream commercial media, the North Coast Times-Eagle might be considered a forum for impractical, perhaps Paleolithic dreams of a less grim future than prophesied by millennial myths and terrors, a beacon for an equally ancient concept of personal and collective freedom, in history only a dream, but its most persistent dream. Mouses must roar after all and bite at the ankles of ponderous tyrannies if we are to keep our heads in humor. Micromedia, flamboyant, irreverent, raffish, and Raggedy Ann, is on the march into the 21st century. 2 decades after its birth, the North Coast Times-Eagle remains on the endangered list at the end of the 20th century and the terminus of the Oregon Trail, where Lewis and Clark spent the rainiest winter of their lives in a never-dry little fort they built on a river later named after them. Like the explorers and ancestors whose hard wagon wheels rutted the virgin plains and fertilized them with their dead, the newspaper is a hopeful pioneer striving for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness at the mouth of the Columbia River and at the fringe of sensibility. A past of Conestogas and a future of starships straddle its double life. Pained optimism is its stimulation. I.F. Stone, who died 10 years ago in 1989 at age 82, wrote, "To be a pariah is to be left alone to see things your own way, as truthfully as you can. Not because you're brighter than anyone else, or your own truth so valuable, but because, like a painter or a writer or an artist, all you have to contribute is the publication of your own vision, and add that to the sum total of other visions. To be regarded as non-respectable, to be a pariah, to be an outsider, this is really the way to do it, to sit in your tub and not want anything. As soon as you want something, they've got you." And that was Izzy Stone, whom I regard as one of, if not the greatest, American journalist. Well, I'd like to continue on with my own heresies. I wrote an article last year promoting myself as president. I'd like to read parts of it, but only under the aegis that if I, a common citizen, were president, this is more or less what I would do. And then from that menu, I make my vote to see whoever comes closest to it. So once again, my disclaimer is still in place. I suppose if I were president, I would agree with Harry Truman that the only real power of the presidency should be to convince people what they ought to have the good sense to do on their own. If I were president, I would rather give a dollar for the welfare of the poor than another cent to the plutocrats who pillage the public treasury in the twin rubrics of corporate research and development and national defense security. Because of what President Eisenhower admitted to be a military-industrial control of the nation's politics and economy, We are more insecure politically and psychologically than any time previously. Much of the nation's poverty is a result of the very few controlling most of the nation's wealth and resources, with little sense of responsibility for having nullified our constitutional democracy and limiting the prospects of its people. As president, I would ensure education as a major priority regardless of other pressing needs. We are a nation face forward to the future, yet contradictorily plunder the futures of our heirs by scrimping on their education, making it too expensive and simultaneously more mediocre. I would upgrade public education at all levels and would especially reinstate nationally the former system of California state universities and make college free, yet scholastically competitive, rather than financially as at present. To paraphrase Marx, education ought to be, quote, for each according to his or her ability, from all according to common need. As president, I would be unequivocally committed to women's free choice. For some reason, men who abdicate the responsibility for birth control believe they have the right to control a woman's options, which has less to do with concern for the unborn fetus than it does retaining supremacy over women. The hypocrisy is that women have had to make these decisions for thousands of years. Women have been responsible for birth control or forced to be the instruments of euthanasia in regards to unwanted children in the vacuum left by irresponsible men. Abortion at least allows a woman to dispose of a child before it is born. Humanity is crowding itself off its home planet. Abortion is a survival mechanism that attempts, consciously or subliminally, to alleviate the ever-increasing ravage of Earth by an overabundant species that seldom practices successful birth control. In the bad old days, children were slaughtered or abandoned when a population overran its resources. Abortion, and particularly the French abortion pill RU486, is a more preferable option than an AIDS or Ebola epidemic in stabilizing population growth. Yet abortion causes furious arguments and is such an emotional issue that a civil war of sorts is erupting between so-called pro-life and pro-choice forces. As president, I would abolish all attempts to nail the biblical Ten Commandments to schoolhouse walls, an insipid symbolic act by self-righteous idiots who have no concept why children are killing each other, and instead put up the real Ten Commandments of democracy, the Bill of Rights, which might give hope and inspiration to alienated youth who might otherwise resort to gunfire. As president, I would drastically reform the tax system in favor of the taxpayer, first guaranteeing each an accounting of their money used by every level of government, and that basic returns for that money be automatic priorities such as food, shelter, and health care. The present system of required payment of taxes without any accountability for their use by government must be reversed, which is possible with computerization of all public agencies. It will eventually be possible in such a system that taxpayers have the legal power to determine where their tax monies are spent. As president, I would charge the entire national debt to corporations that not only owe billions of dollars in back taxes, but have received huge refunds of public money for taxes they never paid. The burden has been on the average taxpayer who receives only the bill, but not the profits of the national debt, which has been incurred appropriating non-existent public money to those same corporations. As president, I would immediately put into effect rigorous environmental laws to stop the poisoning and ravaging of Earth. I would quit subsidizing and protecting major polluters and devastators and instead use that money to pay the wages of those who will have to work at reversing the damage. Hundreds of thousands will probably lose their jobs and will be necessary to retrain them for other work, perhaps cleaning up what they were paid to pollute or ravage, regardless of how modest their contributions to the national global junkyard. Jobs will mean nothing if the air is unfit to breathe and the planet is baked like a pie. In conjunction with what will most likely seem at first draconian environmental ecological measures, as president I would directly fund research and development of alternative sources of energy that have long been abandoned but are more necessary than ever, such as solar, geothermal, water, and wind power, to replace the fossil fuels that have built and maintained our present civilization, but have, as their cost, imperiled life on the planet. I would not restart the nuclear power industry, which continues to claim to be the solution to atmospheric pollution. On the contrary, the nuclear lobby squelched alternative energy development that has set back its application for years, and yet we still need to find a suitable and safe solution to the problem of nuclear waste.
As president, I would decriminalize. As president, I would decriminalize illegal drugs, which I believe will dry up the huge profits made by drug lords and significantly curb the massive corruption and violent crime terrorizing the nation. The precedent for this belief is the repeal of prohibition. Hypocrisy is the word for the war on drugs, which selectively prohibits the use of some substances and tolerates the use of others that are as or more dangerous to public health, such as alcohol and tobacco, which have killed millions. The entire society is criminalized and corrupted while drugs remain illegal and thus immensely profitable. Public officials and financial institutions are purchased by the drug lords while Congress dismantles the rights of those accused of minor drug use, which incites repressive police practices in general, while ballooning their budgets. Law enforcement is the other profiteer of illegal drugs, and overcrowds prisons with non-criminals. I believe the supply of dangerous and addictive drugs will be considerably less when there is no longer big money made in the trade. As president, I would end the malign neglect of the huge and growing underclass that lives abandoned and without hope in our crumbling inner cities and impoverished rural areas. Millions of children live in poverty in the USA, most of them not white, which significantly lessens their chances of escaping destitution due to this country's prevailing racism. Dr. Charles Wilder, former director of Clatsop County Community Action Agency, once said that the war on poverty has become a war on the poor. As president, I believe my very first executive order should be to begin reversing the upward flow of the nation's wealth. I would instead make the arid trickle down a flood. The disparities in wealth and living standards undermine our society and threaten civil disorder on a massive scale. Already the young gangs in inner cities are a grim specter of the future if we as a society refuse to right the inequities we have allowed. As president, I would implement Thomas Paine's idea that every 20-year-old citizen of the USA be given a monetary stake, women as well as men, because the very notion of democracy is rooted in the thought that everyone born into it, quote, shall inherit some means of beginning in the world, unquote. And that's from Paine. This idea should be extended into the 21st century with the understanding that an adequate amount, say $100,000 bequeathed to every young person on their 20th birthday, albeit obvious questions of eligibility, should the already wealthy receive a stake, would go a long way toward eradicating the inequality of opportunity in this country. As president, I would encourage companies from all over the world to locate plants and facilities in the USA with the provision they hire American workers, whose jobs are lost when American companies go offshore in the search for cheap labor in the third world, and train them for highly skilled labor. I would encourage these foreign companies to engage in research and development, which will benefit all sectors of society, and might also contribute to breaking down trade barriers. Unions must be revitalized and include women and minorities in leadership positions, and they should be given political and legal protections to enable them to negotiate strong labor contracts with foreign and domestic corporations that operate in this country. As president, I would not only share our highest levels of technology, possibly through the United Nations, to level out progress worldwide, but also make it possible for low-tech nations to gain technology without the rape of resources and the environment that characterize the West's industrial evolution. As president, I would eliminate the Electoral College as an antiquated and unfairly tilted and unintentionally corrupt process that resists the brave new world of participatory democracy made possible by the Internet. And as president, I would consolidate all discharges from the armed forces into a single category, in particular eliminating dishonorable, undesirable, and bad conduct discharges, which have ruined the futures of hundreds of thousands of veterans who ran afoul of an authoritarian, anti-democratic system that demands unremitting obedience and strips its enlisted members of their civil liberties. Only for serious crimes committed while in service should a discharge be other than general. Veterans have fought for this single type of discharge for years without success. Of course, there are multitudes of other problems and issues. Reestablishing necessary domestic programs, introducing a wealth tax and raising consumption taxes, trimming farm subsidies, instituting a successful and long overdue public health care system, care and support for AIDS and future epidemic victims, rebuilding the disintegrating transportation network with special emphasis on mass transit, preservation and renewal of wetlands and wildlands, retaining public support of the arts, revitalization of a national public service organization for young people that would be a combination of VISTA and the Civilian Conservation Corps of the 1930s. An endless list, never satisfied, always in conflict. My final act as president will be to abdicate in favor of my vice president, who would most certainly be a woman. She will be right and choice, be the first president of the millennium. And that's what I would do if I were president. And that's the menu which I judge the candidates on. And I don't see either of the major parties addressing that.
You've been listening to a special archive edition of Michael McCusker's A Story Told. Special thanks to Larry Zeek for saving these recordings by transferring them to CD.